Ladies and gentlemen, let me welcome you here to our campus. We are honored this evening in having Sir Julian and Lady Huxley here on our campus. I wonder if, prior to my introduction of Sir Julian, I might ask Lady Huxley if she would stand, and will you join with me in welcoming her here, please? Lady Huxley. At the end of World War II, I had a privilege of being withdrawn and sent to Balliol College, Oxford University, for an altogether too brief period of time. It was quite a change from the unbelief of Buchenwald and the completely shattered Köln and Darmstadt, to go into Balliol in its quiet quadrangle and have an opportunity of getting back into academic life, to read, to think and discuss with other people. It was a delightful experience and truly a refreshing one. There you had a feeling of the tradition and the certainty that is Oxford, and in particular, this is a little bit prejudicial, Balliol College. Our honored guest this evening comes from this distinguished background, a scholar educated at Eton and at Balliol College. He lectured in zoology at Balliol. He taught for a time in this country, was a fellow and senior demonstrator at New College, Oxford. He was a member of the Oxford expedition to Spitsbergen, a professor of zoology at King's College London, professor of physiology at the Royal Institute. He supervised a number of biological films, was secretary of the Zoological Society of London. In 1956, he gave the Beatty Lectures at McGill University in Canada, and in the same year received the Darwin Medal from the Royal Society. He was created a knight in 1958. An author of unusual ability, he has written or edited, sometimes in cooperation with others, well over 40 books. These cover a broad spectrum of his interests, from biology to discussion of evolution, including, for the benefit of the members of the theological faculty and student body, religion without revelation, the uniqueness of man, evolutionary ethics, man in the modern world, if I were a dictator. In 1929, he wrote a book with H.G. and G.P. Wells, The Science of Life, a work which, in the minds of some of our scientists, was to become the first really modern text in biology. His most recent work, The Human Crisis, was drawn from the John Dance Lectures at the University of Washington. He was a member of the Commission on Higher Education for West Africa, a member of the Commission on National Parks in the United Kingdom. He's received honorary degrees from universities literally all over the world. He was executive secretary of the United Nations Educational and Cultural Organization Preparatory Commission, and served as Director General of UNESCO. My colleagues, students, my friends, a scholar, an author, a planner, a public servant to all men through UNESCO, I am pleased and we are honored as a university to have with us this evening Sir Julian Huxley. Will you welcome him with me, please?
Thank you very much, sir. Now, you may wonder, perhaps, at my title, The Humanist Revolution. I dare say you imagine you had enough revolutions. You had two very important ones in this part of the world. You had the Appalachian Revolution that gave you your mountains, and you had the American Revolution which gave you your freedom. But this revolution I'm talking about is far more revolutionary. It is a real revolution in our way of thinking about our place and role in the universe, and in ways of organizing our own existence. And I call it the humanist revolution, for lack of a better term, because it is essentially and primarily related not to the state or to God or to future life or to an ideological and an economic ideological system, but to the evolving human species as a whole and its possibilities. And it's been brought about by the conjunction of two truly extraordinary and probably unique events in the 3 billion year history of life on this planet. First of all, the fact that a dominant and probably irreplaceable type of organism, namely ourselves, is threatening to destroy its own habitat, its own way of life, and even itself. And secondly, what I may call the new vision of reality, virtually a new revelation, which has been provided for us by what I call the knowledge explosion of the last 100 years, through which the evolutionary process in the person of man is at last becoming conscious of itself, of its essential nature and its possible future. Now, you have, first of all, this terrifying, destructive aspect that we're threatening to destroy ourselves and our habitat. Destruction is everywhere been outrunning creation. We've had these two vast wars in which we've been killing each other and smashing more buildings and beautiful works of art and all the rest of it than in the whole of human history. We've had everywhere there is conflict, often accompanied by organized hatred, class conflict, ideological conflict, economic conflict, all the rest of it. Then we've had the destruction of beauty, both in city and country. We've had the loss of our belief in moral purpose, absolutely shattered by the horrors of the Nazi organized persecutions, by the revival of torture, even by things like the use of napalm bombs. We've had the loss of our belief in general progress, which was so general in the 19th century, and a general pessimism and confusion and indeed chaos in the world of literature and the arts. We've got a very notable failure of the traditional religions, and worst of all, for so many people, a destruction of their sense of significance, of meaning something, of being anything more than just a cog in a materialistic machine. We've had the destruction of our own cultural unity, what C.P. Snow has called a split between our two cultures. We've had the destruction of cultural variety between cultures through the spread of cheap mass-produced goods, and within nations by the pressure of conformism. We've had increasing frustration in the big cities. We've had it between the rich and poor, between nations, what's been called the revolution of expectation. We've had it as between the privileged and underprivileged classes. Well, you're now having it in this country. The Negroes quite rightly expect real equality and not just lip service. You've had automation destroying the old idea of the dignity of labor, indeed the very notion of jobs in the old sense. And you've had a destruction of general confidence. You've had everywhere there's fear of the atomic bomb, and accompanied by this consciousness of this ghastly farce of exceedingly expensive weapons, which we all hope will never be used, what's called the ultimate deterrent. I sometimes think they ought to be called the ultimate detergent, because they could wipe us off the face of the earth. And perhaps most serious of all, the population explosion, the threat of overpopulation pressing on our resources, on the habitat, the world we inhabit, on our happiness and enjoyment, on indeed our whole future. And to put it rather brutally, the real possibility that man may become the cancer of the planet, destroy his own habitat, and in the process destroy his own possibilities and future. Well, that is pretty depressing, and I think most people agree that this is a depressing period in many ways. But on the other hand, there is an exciting challenge and a hopeful side to it all. The new vision which has been given us by the knowledge explosion, since I would date it from Darwin's Origin of Species in 1859, and especially rapid in the last 50 years. It's not only an explosion in the physical and biological sciences, but also in medicine, but also in the human sciences, in psychology, and anthropology, and also in academic learning, in the humanities, in our knowledge of the history and prehistory and archaeology of our own species. It's simply been amazing what has happened there. New civilizations discovered. When I was a boy, Arthur Evans discovered the Cretan civilization, which people didn't know about before. And now we have histories of art, histories of religion, history of science, and all the rest of it. And as I say, this has really given us a new revelation. It is the first time in man's history that we have got a reasonably true and reasonably comprehensive vision of our own nature, our own history, and of our place and role in nature, both in space and time, and also of our human shortcomings and our possibilities. And this can be, this is a challenge, it can be a give us a unified pattern of thought and belief, and so for the first time we should be able to frame a unitary aim for man. As I say, evolution becoming self-conscious and developing a fact-based purpose. That is, to me, the essence of what I call the humanist revolution, to meet the urgent conflicts and frustrations and aimlessness and negativism of the present situation, to meet them quickly enough with the aid of the new knowledge and skills and understanding which are now lying ready to our hands. Well, perhaps hands isn't the right word, to our minds, to our intellect, to our imagination. Now, when I speak of this new vision, what do I really mean? This is a vast subject. I try and sketch it in broad lines. This new vision is an evolutionary one, concerned with the process of realizing possibilities. The main point to grasp is that we now realize that the whole of phenomenal reality, including ourselves, is evolution. If you use that word in the sense of a transformation in time, which is self-operating and generates, in its course, generates novelty and variety and higher organization and increased mind. And then when you look closer, you see that this is divisible into three sharply marked phases, each separated by what a physicist would call a critical point, where there's a rapid and radical change, each of them with a different mechanism of change, a different tempo of change, and different types of result. Well, the first, of course, is the basic one, is the inorganic, the cosmic, with its vast spaces of millions and millions of light years, it's millions and millions of nebulae, each with millions and millions of stars and so forth. An incredibly slow change, to be measured perhaps in billion-year periods. Mechanism of change, almost entirely just physical interaction, occasionally a little chemical interaction, with and very low organization in the results. Most of the inorganic phase is in the subatomic state or in the form of light waves, so on. But here again, you get your here and there, you get your spiral organization of the galaxies, and you get your stars with their concentric shells, and rarely you get planetary systems, more complex, with a star with planets, and on them you get the formation of new elements, and you get more chemical compounds. And the general trend, as far as I understand my physical colleagues, is in accordance with the second law of thermodynamics to increasing entropy, that is to say, to the degradation of organization. Now, the first critical point was when matter, to put it epigrammatically, became self-reproducing, that is to say, when it became alive. And this we only know for certain about on our own planet. It must have happened on a number of other planets all over the universe. We are beginning to know something about how it happened. I won't try and go into that now. Oparin's book will tell you. But as a result of a long process which was set on by the impact of ultraviolet light on the planet in its primitive state, you eventually got self-reproducing compounds, presumably like DNA, which we talk about so much now. And these are not only self-reproducing, but they are also self-varying in the sense that the small chemical changes or changes in position can take place either because it's knocked about by something from outside, chemical or light energy or something, or because of spontaneous rearrangements, and you get what's called a mutation, and that reproduces itself. And furthermore, either from the very beginning, or certainly from a very, very early stage, you had, they were self-recombining, you had these threads, presumably, of self-reproducing matter, able to exchange their mutations with each other, just as you get in sexual reproduction in higher animals and plants, and so the degree of variation was much increased. Now, the immediate consequence of that is what Darwin called natural selection, which is merely a shorthand phrase for the results of the differential survival of the more favorable genetic variants in a population. And this means that there will be much faster rate of change, major changes measured perhaps in 100 million year periods. And you will get totally new types of results, the chief result being that you get organisms, and you get an increasingly high degree of organization, so that the process looked at in one sense is anti-entropic, is going against the second law. Of course, it can only do this with the aid of the energy it gets from the sun, but you do get an increase in the amount and level of organization during the process. And also, and this is part of what Darwin, in 1859 already, called improvement. He wrote, with his customary caution and sanity, that natural selection inevitably would cause improvement in the majority of organisms in relation to their conditions of life, and that's just what it does. What I want to point out is that this is not, and none of this is purposeful in the proper sense. There's no conscious or unconscious purpose behind it. It is an automatic direction of living matter in a general direction. It's what Pittendrig calls teleonomic, that's to say directed in a direction rather than teleological, animated by a purpose. Now, if you look at the total amount of improvement that's taken place in the close on 3 billion years that life's been in existence, it really is incredible. From what must have been originally not merely subcellular, but submicroscopic units of living matter, up to creatures weighing 5 and 6 tons, capable of remembering and manipulating and so on, like an elephant, to creatures with patterned color vision, to creatures capable of flying at 100 miles an hour, like chimney swifts, to organized communities like bees and ants, to mammals with maternal care, family life, what one must call maternal emotion, maternal love, and even self-sacrifice, and finally to curiosity for its own sake, and to what I find so interesting, to play and activities which are performed for the sake of the enjoyment they bring, for their own sake, you get in many higher mammals. Now, this is accompanied, of course, with a vast amount of suffering, waste and failure, extinction of things, but the general result is overall improvement. One type of improvement is diversification. It means that you can utilize the resources of your environment more thoroughly, as for instance by having plants versus animals, by having herbivores versus carnivores, by having the development of ecological communities which are balanced and through which eventually you get, as your great statistician Lotka pointed out years ago, which tend to maximize the energy flow through themselves. And you get every new successful type radiating out into the diversity of ways of life, like the reptiles, flying reptiles, giant reptiles, running reptiles, swimming reptiles, all the rest of it. Besides that, you get the fantastic diversity of detailed adaptation, protective coloration, adaptation to very special ways of life, and so on, which is really miraculous in the proper sense of that word. One inevitably marvels at it. And it comes about because, as our great geneticist R. A. Fisher, who recently died, once said, natural selection is a mechanism for generating an extremely high degree of improbability. A paradoxical remark, which has a great deal of truth in it. And you have this incredible variety and delicacy and beauty of adaptation to interest us and for us to enjoy. One final point I'd like to make is that major improvement, really big steps in advance, always come about through rather rare breakthroughs, which I can best illustrate from the evolution of land vertebrates. First, land vertebrates, as you all know, were clumsy amphibians with moist skins, having to live half their life as tadpoles in water. And it wasn't until after about 100 million years that probably one, possibly two lines broke through to become true reptiles with scaly skin, shelled egg, and so on, and truly terrestrial animals. And then there was another 150 million years, perhaps, before you got the further breakthrough. There were two of these only, one to the birds, one to the mammals, both of them to creatures capable of regulating their temperature instead of going up and down with the outside temperature, and with the mammals, with the higher mammals, with this marvelous arrangement for nourishing the young before birth inside the safety of the mother's womb. You get another process, which I may call the process of stabilization, limitation. You get lines of advance which come to an end. They can't go further. They may not be able to go further because, like insects, they cannot get bigger than about half the size of a mouse. They just wouldn't work because of their breathing apparatus. You couldn't get a horse. The horse lion became more and more adapted for fast running and grazing, eating grass and so on, and it's got to the limit. Any further specialization would be useless. Now, the point that struck me, and I don't think all my fellow biologists agree with it, is this, that perhaps 10 million years ago at latest, purely biological improvement came to an end. It was no longer possible to improve the physiological anatomical mechanisms of animals. You just can't get an eye because of the type of cells of which it's made, which has more acute vision than that of a falcon. You can't get a land animal much bigger than an elephant without its becoming unworkable. You can't get temperature regulation. There's no point in getting temperature regulation more accurate than what we or a bird has. You can't get a creature with higher speed than a chimney swift in the air. So what happened? You then got a new breakthrough at a new critical point, which was in regard to mind. To put it rather epigrammatically, whereas matter had become self-reproducing before, now mind became self-reproducing in a certain sense through the evolution of true speech, which with the ability to communicate true speech with symbols for objects and ideas instead of just noises for emotions and feelings. And this means that you can build up a tradition within the group, which then can be transmitted to the next generation. So you have a second method of inheritance, the inheritance of what you've learned and what you've made, as well as the inheritance due to your chromosomes and genes in your germ cells. And the point about this is that tradition is or can be cumulative, which is most clearly shown in the growth of science, whereas genetic inheritance is not cumulative, it just goes on at a steady rate, change goes on at a rate. And this brings you to the third phase, which I call the psychosocial or human phase, with this second method of inheritance, in which natural selection is quite secondary to psychological and social selection. You get an immensely faster tempo of change, and what is more, you get a constant tendency to acceleration, whereas in biological evolution you got a more or less steady rate of change. And the whole process becomes more anti-entropic. You get higher organization being created with less expenditure of energy. And the final point is that visible evolution is primarily cultural, shown by works of art, buildings, systems of law, and all the rest of it, and only secondarily genetic. And of course, you get totally new kinds of results. You don't get new kinds of organisms. The human species is just one species, but you get something which never appeared in the world before. You get sciences, arts, laws, religions, wars, and all the rest of it. And you still find the same three general processes going on as in biology. You get diversification of cultures, you get improvement, which is very obvious in small improvements, like the improvement of a particular invention like the automobile, but you also get major improvement, and major improvement again is always a rare phenomenon, is a breakthrough of a new idea, a new way of understanding and coping with nature. Most obvious examples were the changeover from hunting and food gathering to agriculture, and then the changeover from agriculture to civilization with writing and so forth, and division of labor, and the birth of the idea of universalism, that things could be universally true, whether scientific or religious, and then of course the greatest revolution up till the present, the scientific revolution, which started in the 17th century. And of course some of the major improvement which has taken place again has been staggering. I mean, since even in the last 3,000 years, there's been a doubling of the general lifespan of man. There's been this not only reducing but practically conquering infectious disease, and of course most spectacular, controlling physical aspects of nature mechanically, and most important of all, the incredible increase of knowledge together with more and better education. Though here again, as with biological education, this improvement is accompanied with a terrible lot of waste and failure and often horror and cruelty, so that you have to say that as in biology, progress or improvement is certainly not universal and is not inevitable, but is possible, so that we may have not just a blind optimism, but a tempered optimism that it is possible to get further improvement. In addition, you get stabilization. You can't go further if you're only a food gatherer than a certain very primitive level of social organization. Without mechanical industrialization, you had to rely largely on slave labor, so on, things like that. And you have types of social organization which are self-defeating. The Assyrian Empire was self-defeating. Hitler's Germany was self-defeating. And I think at the moment that a lot of elements in our present civilization are being so self-defeating. And finally, you get a new phenomenon. You get what the anthropologists call diffusion, the diffusion of culture, of ideas and objects from one culture to another, which of course accelerates the rate of progress and makes for increasing unity. And now we have what I still maintain is the biggest breakthrough of all, to a new pattern of thought and belief, and I hope action, which is based on established scientific knowledge and fact, instead of on myth or on pretended supernatural revelation or on dictatorial fiat. So you have this new vision of destiny, and in a nutshell it is this, that man's destiny is to guide and direct the future of evolution on this planet and his own evolution. An immense privilege, but also terrifying responsibility. It can so easily go wrong. On the other hand, we must remember that he's got a vast time ahead of him, unless he destroys himself by some nuclear stupidity, probably equal to the past, at least another 3 billion years, quite a long time, to make a few mistakes and remedy them. And an important point that most people don't realize is that man is, as a biological type, exceedingly young. It's only about 1 million years old. What's that in relation to 3 billion years? And as for civilized man, he's only just arrived, less than 10,000 years old. That's just one tick of the cosmic clock. He's also extremely imperfect, even as man. As Teilhard de Chardin said, the process of hominization has only just really begun. He has enormous possibilities of improvement, both genetically, socially, morally, emotionally, and so on. Now, the essential point is this, that man is both a product of and an active agent in this overall evolutionary process of realizing possibilities. He's made of the same matter as all the rest of the universe. He's operated by the same energy. His mind works in the same sort of way, maybe rather more elaborate than that of his higher animals, and so on. So that, if I may repeat myself, this is a truly critical breakthrough, and so that evolution is becoming conscious of itself. And one of the big results of this is that dualism, philosophic or religious dualism, is, so far as I can see, no longer a possible way of looking at things. There isn't a split between two different realms of nature. Everything in the universe is natural, including values, moral values, including religions, spiritual experiences, and all the rest of it. This is very exciting because we're getting a breakthrough into this really new luminous atmosphere of evolutionary understanding, rather like the breakthrough of vertebrates from their watery bondage to the freedom and also the challenge and also the opportunity of living in air. But we are very imperfect. Our present state of civilization, even at its highest, is more to be compared with clumsy, horrible old labyrinthodonts of the Devonian period than to a lovely bird or swift mammal. Now, this is a very general trying to give a very general picture of how we have, I think, to look at things now. Well, don't let's be content with just having a nice general picture. Events, this crucial urgency of events, make it imperative to apply this knowledge, this new vision, as soon as we can. We must remember that improvement, getting out of our present predicament, won't be automatic. It needs a great deal of hard thinking, vivid imagination, and disciplined effort. Now, very briefly, let me run through. We've got to try and apply this new knowledge to the various frightening problems that are now besetting us. Well, very quickly, I run through some of the biggest ones. First of all, there's the problem of war, which is bound up with the problem of political disunity. It's quite clear we must persevere in the effort to abolish nuclear arms and indeed to get a large disarmament program. And we must try and do it step by step, not all at once. We also want to get more political unity. There again, it's, I think, useless and stupid to say we'll start world government the day after tomorrow. I found when I was at UNESCO that if you began talking in terms of principles, you always got a terrible lot of arguments and didn't get any results. If you could get a lot of nations to agree that a certain project was worth trying to do, then you would get them interested, and then you would get practical results, and you would also get greater degree of agreement on general principles. So I think we've got to concentrate on projects which make for greater political and economic interdependence and unity over the world. One pretty obvious thing to do pretty soon is to get China into the United Nations instead of leaving her out in the cold, refusing to talk to her. I mean, you can't expect to get, I mean, you must be able to discuss problems over a table. You sometimes have some trouble doing that with people who are your opponents, but it's much better to get them over a table than not have them there at all. Now, the next problem, threat, is the increasing pressure on resources, not only material resources, but also what I would call enjoyment resources. You have, for instance, you have pressure on minerals. The oil will be finished in a few decades, coal perhaps in a few centuries. What's that in the history of the world? There's even pressure now on what we were accustomed to think of as a universal abundant source, namely water. We're already getting pressure on water in our wet island down in the southeast corner of England through population. California's having to get water all the way from Southern California, from Northern California, 850 miles away, and so on. And what's more, we're not only pressing on water and air, but we're polluting them. I saw some appalling figures the other day. The total volume of effluents which are discharged into the air, no, I think only into the waters of this world, amount to something like 400 cubic kilometers per annum, which if you do a little arithmetic means the equivalent of a mountain about 20,000 feet high, vertical sides, and about four square miles on top. And it really is getting terrible. You are having, I found to my horror, that it's now no longer safe to bathe in the Swiss lakes because of the sewage, and same is true for some of our beaches on the south coast of Britain. The rivers in Britain are being poisoned. You've just had millions of fish killed in the Mississippi, and so on. So, I don't want to be flippant, but it does rather look as if our boasted affluent society was turning into an effluent society, which is very unpleasant. Then we are cutting down our forests at a terrible rate and eroding our soil. We're cutting down our forests largely to satisfy this prodigious urge of the American people, or at any rate the American newspaper and magazine proprietors, for more newsprint. I was once told that the New York Times every Sunday had more words in it than the Bible, and I once had an idle Sunday in New York, and I went through the New York Times, and it is, I think, true. It's certainly about that order of magnitude. I don't think the words are worth so much as those in the Bible, but quantitatively it's true. And this means that you are cutting down just to produce the Sunday edition of the New York Times every Sunday throughout the year, an area of forest nearly as big as the county of Staffordshire in England. Well, this pressure on resources is really serious. Then we have the whole problem of science, how you would apply it, which fields you would concentrate on, and so forth. I think the time is coming when the notion of each science pursuing its own line up to the limit is coming to an end, where we shall more and more have more and more sciences all converging on problems. We've already had the International Geophysical Year, now we're preparing the International Biological Program. To put it in the most general way, ecology, that's to say the science of the relations of organisms, including man, with their environment and the resources of their environment and with each other, is going to be not the basic science, but the focal science, the science on which all the others will have to concentrate. And the application of ecology is wise conservation and optimum land use. This is going to be more and more important in education, in application, everywhere else. And of course, when you come to human ecology, you have some terrifying problems because you've got a totally new phenomenon. You have the growth of these fantastically big cities which are getting non-viable. I mean, they're getting as non-viable almost as an elephant weighing 20 tons would be. London is just choking itself. We've just had Buchanan's masterly report on the problem of how to make it possible for man and the automobile to live side by side in cities without the automobile becoming dominant, and which is, I mean, that is the case in Los Angeles. I mean, Los Angeles is nothing but a lot of freeways and cars speeding along them with a lot of garages and service stations and a few houses up on the hills and round about. But this mere problem of size of cities is posing a new problem. How you are going to live in cities which cut you off from nature, where you want to use a car but you can't park it, where you are destroying beauty and creating ugliness, and of course the new phenomenon that it's not merely the cities are growing, that just you're getting what is neither one thing nor the other, has been called slurbs, mixture of slums and suburbs, or as other people have said, urban sprawl. There is an urban sprawl, including the cities, but also including all the non-cities, all the way from southern Maine to Washington. Masses people have said that dirt is matter in the wrong place. Well, sprawl is houses in the wrong place. And as I say, it's neither country, suburb, city, town, or anything else. And we're having special pressure on enjoyment resources for recreation and solitude and beauty, landscape, wildlife, and so on. No sooner do we in England start a national park than the Atomic Energy Authority wants to put up an atomic station there, or the military want to put up a bombing range or something. It's getting more and more difficult. And even in this country, with its wonderful system of national parks, I understand that the demand is so great that some of them are really getting what you make. You don't get overkill, you get over-visiting. And of course, this is becoming particularly acute in the old world, where all the great, what I would call, pilgrimage sites, places that people want to visit for their religious associations or for their historical associations or for the sheer beauty of their architecture and so forth, are just getting so crowded with sightseers that you can't see the sights most of the year. And I've only seen one remedy for this, put up rather sarcastically, which was that you've got to build duplicates, but I think, don't think this is really likely to. But it is a very real problem. Then the direction of research. It's perfectly clear to anybody who looks at it dispassionately that research is very much misdirected. I mean, there's over concentration on some fields, like weaponry, so-called, and on this business of exploring outer space and getting to the moon before the Russians, and much too little on human problems. And I would say, instead of concentrating on exploring outer space, let's explore the far more interesting area of inner space, the inner space inside our minds, with it is really the habitat of man's spiritual habitat, which has all sorts of unexplored nooks and possibilities waiting to be discovered and understood and realized. So that if you want to sum it up in a phrase, well, we're very much in need of a science of human possibilities. Instead of just thinking of how to exploit this or that, this scientific discovery to give greater profit or greater efficiency, as I say, what can we do in the way of developing human possibilities more fully? Well, What Margaret Mead once called, we need to establish chairs of the future. It's rather nice to be a professor of the future, wouldn't it? You wouldn't have to pay so much attention to the present. And then, of course, I left to the end the gravest threat of all, the population explosion. It's the gravest threat of all because it is internal. It's not like nuclear weapons, which are, after all, something which we've made ourselves and we needn't go on making. But the threat comes from our instincts and nature. And it is something unique because, as I say, never before in the history of the life on this planet, so far as we know, has there ever been a dominant type of organism which is threatening to destroy itself in its own habitat. If I may just remind you of a few figures to remind you of the appalling quantitative measure of this explosion, it is the world's population is increasing by 60 million people every year. Well, 60 million, you know, a lot of noughts and all that, doesn't register perhaps, but this means over 160,000 people every 24 hours, that's to say quite a large town. And if you want to bring it down even more immediately, it means every minute the equivalent of 11 baseball teams complete with coach. 110 people per minute. So I've been talking for 43 minutes. That's 43 new potential baseball teams come into the world. And it's not only these quantitative numbers, but the rate of increase is going up. For most of human history, the rate of increase must have been right somewhere about a tenth of 1%. It only reached 1% per annum in the present century. It's already 1.75%, and it's still going up. And that's not all. There's a differential rate between the rich countries and the poor countries, and the poor countries, which are already underdeveloped and overpopulated, are increasing faster. And none of them have a rate less than 2.5%, and I just read quite recently that Costa Rica has achieved a record. It's increasing at the rate of 4.4% per annum, which means it doubles in 13 and a half years. What can you do with a country, what country's economy, which doubles itself in 13 and a half years? It just is appalling. And the gap between the rich and the poor countries, instead of getting narrower, is widening. Furthermore, you can't industrialize a non-industrialized country unless you reduce its birth rate, because so much of the capital and skill needed to industrialize will go down the drain, looking after the extra mouths to feed, extra children to house and educate and all the rest of it. And yet there is this really monstrous gap. I mean, the expectation of life in India is only about half that, or less than half what it is in my country or your country. Disparity in income is perhaps 20 to 25 to 1 in steel production and so on. And education, I should say, about the same. When you get to newsprint, I think it's over 100 to 1. And as a result, you're having this revolution of expectation. These poor people, they know what's been done by science and technology for the rich countries, and they quite rightly expect something of the sort for themselves. And if they don't get it, a reasonable amount, there'll be immense amount of discontent, frustration, unrest, revolution, dictatorship, even war. So that it's in our interest to try to get down the rate of population. The only way I think that we can get over this terrifying prospect is by, for one thing, not thinking in terms of just aid like charity from the rich to the poor countries, but collaboration and cooperation in projects of world development. And secondly, we've got to take into account the state of their population situation. just as a banker will demand some evidence of creditworthiness from potential customer, so I think the World Bank and aid granting bodies, or by AID in America, if given a request for aid, should look into the demographic creditworthiness of the applicant country. And if they don't judge it sufficient, they say, well, we can't give you your aid like that and like this unless you embark on a population policy which we approve of, and we will give some of the money to help you carry it out. I feel sure that will come in some sort of form within a few years. And you must have everywhere a population policy. You've just got to get the rate of population of the world down to manageable proportions. 1.75% will lead to a quadrupling of the population, quadrupling of the present 3 billion population in about 55 years. Well, that's just nothing. And you've got to have family planning, as I prefer to call it, with birth control facilities, incorporated in every country as part of whatever public health service you have. And there's got to be a general United Nations policy which will be in the background of the individual ones. And as I say, the aim is to get the rates of increase down to manageable proportions, or as a British statesman once said, you've got to get the stork flying backwards, which I thought was a rather nice way of putting it. I would personally say that the ultimate aim will be to reduce the total number of people in the world. I think there are probably too many for an ideal world. But at the moment, you just got to see what you can do to get things down to manageable proportions, which they are not now. And meanwhile, I do think that it is immoral, in the deepest sense of the word, for any individual, any organization, any religious or other organization, to put obstacles in the way of letting people know how to control the number of their children according to their work. It is anti-democratic, and it is increasing the amount of misery and degradation and frustration in the world. Well, now, one thing this population explosion is doing for us, it's making us ask a number of very fundamental questions, including a question so fundamental we don't usually ask it: what are people for? Well, when you begin to ask it, you begin to see, well, they're not for a lot of things. They're not just in order to consume more and more material goods in the interests of the people who make them, and not just to provide cannon fodder or military power for a power-hungry nation, and so on. Personally, I can't see anything, any definition of this, except in terms of the word fulfillment, that people are ultimately there in order to that they may achieve greater fulfillment of various types in their ordinary lives by realizing more of their latent possibilities, and which is a correlation of that the groups of people, societies, should be able to make greater achievements, which then can be enjoyed for the greater fulfillment of the individuals in the societies. And if that is so, then we've got radically to rethink our ideas of what sort of a society we need. Before I come to that, I'd just like to mention this, go back to this point of automation. A recent study of the problem in the United States, where automation is going faster than anywhere else and where population is growing quite fast, is this: that this is making your present system, what this very influential committee doesn't say obsolete, but non-viable. It's going to be extinct, like a dinosaur. Just isn't working, because you're going to get, if it goes on as it is at present, a minority of people who are esteemed and have incomes and jobs, and a majority of people who don't have jobs and don't have so much income, can't consume so much, and are less esteemed. And this, in the long run, is bad for the economy, is bad for the morale of people in general, will lead to a great deal of discontent, and so forth. As the committee very pithily puts it, at the present moment, machines and men are competing very strongly for jobs, and on the whole, the machines are winning. So we've got to think, I think, of adjusting our ideas to thinking of a society in which machines will do all the jobs in the ordinary sense of the word, leaving human beings free to live more fully. And how this will be done is a matter for enormous amount of concentrated thought on the part of economists, psychologists, sociologists, and all the rest of it. But unless you do something about it, there's going to be a really terrible crash. Eventually, I think we shall come to some form of eugenics, but I think that's got to wait until we've more or less got the quantitative population increase in hand. Meanwhile, there is one field which I think is very important, where this new vision has important bearings, and that is education, which after all is in a way the most distinctive of all human functions. Our new knowledge will certainly help to not to bridge the split between the so-called two cultures, scientific and humanistic, but will, I think, transcend them. And I think one of our primary aims will be to provide all boys and girls during their high school period with a basic framework of knowledge about the world and man's place in it. And this will mean, I'm sure, having the idea of evolution as your sort of central trunk, as it were, evolution of stars and galaxies, evolution of planetary systems, evolution, geological evolution of the Earth, biological evolution of life, cultural evolution of human cultures, evolution of history, of science, scientific ideas, all the rest of it, from which more specialized side branches can grow out as desired. Then there is the other aspect which my brother Aldous was always so rightly stressing, namely that at the moment, almost everywhere, we concentrate on verbal education, educating through books and written examinations. It's much easier to mark a written examination than to assess a person's real cultural development. But there is all this aspects of non-verbal education which we are terribly neglecting. Just purely physiological side, proper breathing, proper posture, and all the aesthetic appreciation, letting beauties of nature and art, as it were, sink in, accept them with what Wordsworth called wise passiveness, creative activities bringing out unknown, undreamt of possibilities in children, especially children who aren't specially gifted in the verbal way, and so on. And the practice of the arts, music, drama, and so forth, is extremely valuable. And this, I think, it's not merely that we neglect this in our education, we neglect it terribly in our society. If you think of Renaissance Florence, art, painting, architecture, sculpture, so on, music, was part of the life of society, and a very esteemed part. Today, art is sort of leading a hole and corner existence, and artists have been so disgruntled that their They're thinking about their own little private worlds instead of interpreting the great world outside. I think we shall come to a phase where art, just like science, must permeate, interpenetrate the whole of life, whether through good architecture, murals, music, or whatever it may be. After all, art of different sorts, expresses and interprets what is otherwise, much that is otherwise inexpressible and unintelligible. And it also creates new and satisfying organizations, beauty and interest, and so forth. I must say, it is very ironical to find that you have a rich country like America spending, quite rightly and properly, vast sums of money on buying masterpieces, painting and sculpture and so on from other countries, and housing them beautifully in wonderful museums, and building marvelous new art centers like the Lincoln Center. And to my horror, I found when I got to New York that one of the few really good buildings of the present century, the Pennsylvania Railroad Station, just being in process of being pulled down in order to make a little more money out of the site. This seems to me an incredible contradiction, as it were, in terms. Now, to go back to education, I would say that above all, we want to give the boys and girls we're educating the opportunity for various fulfillments during their time they're being educated, for understanding, for intellectual excitement, for physical adventure, for travel, for all the rest of it, so that when they grow up, it will make them want a fulfillment society for themselves and still more for their children. This will be a possible way of achieving this, helping to achieve this vast and drastic changeover, which will be resisted, of course, by an enormous number of vested interests, economic interests, with less difficulty and more peaceably and more quickly than would otherwise be the case. I suppose I must say a word about religion at the end. Sometimes humanists are accused of being anti-religious. This is quite untrue. They do regard religions as natural phenomena, which is not to say that they have played a part. Religion has played a part in all human societies at every level. It is a universal function of man in society. It is it's concerned with helping man to cope with the problem of his destiny, especially in relation to what is felt as sacred or numinous or transcending the immediacy of space and time and common understanding. And it always has three aspects. Any religion, including what people call the pseudo-religions like Nazism and communism and so on, which fulfill a great many of the functions of religions. It always has some sort of supporting and directing framework of ideas, however crudely expressed, of ideas and thought and belief, which when developed is what you call its theology, or in pseudo-religions what you call its ideology. And this largely determines the other two aspects, the other one two being that it always has some code of moral behavior and values, which may be extremely primitive and mechanical, like systems of taboo, or may be highly developed with strong ethical principles. And it always has some form of objective expression in ritual, in ceremonial, in art and music, architecture, and so forth, and symbols. And of course, the pseudo-religions, I mean, Nazism had the most wonderful ceremonials, which apparently were extremely moving, provided you could get over the horror of the ideas behind them. The point that I want to make is that religions evolve like everything else, like law, like morals, like social systems and so forth. Some religions, as far as I can see, have been wholly bad. I can't see anything good, personally, in the ancient Aztec religion. Some, even good religions, have had very bad aspects, like the persecution of heretics in the Middle Ages by a Christian church, Albigenses, the Inquisition, and so on. And, of course, in this country and Western Europe, the horrible witchcraft trials of the 17th century. Also, as everywhere else, there has been a good deal of improvement. Primitive religions are all based on pure magic ideas. Later on, you got the idea of divinities, gods. This gradually consolidated and made universal in the idea of one God. Unfortunately, the various monotheist religions have different ideas of their one God, so that they aren't really universal. And there has been a great deal of repudiation, of persecution, torture, even in religious interests. And you've had one very striking piece of religious evolution in my lifetime, the virtual disappearance of the devil from the religious scene, which is, if you think of how prominent he was only a century ago, is a remarkable example of evolutionary extinction. I have forgotten the exact words that Cromwell used to the Parliament. What was it? I beseech you in the bowels of Christ to search your hearts and see whether you be mistaken. This, I think, is what we ought to say to all people who are dogmatic in religious dogma, in ideological dogma, in economic dogma, or anything else. We have got to realize that we can be mistaken, and there is now a need for new doctrines and ideas and beliefs in religion, as everywhere else, but they should be based on firm but self-correcting methods essentially of science, and they should be not dogmatic in the sense that they resist change almost automatically, but open-ended, capable of evolving in step with the rest of human affairs. Certainly, humanism is not a religion in any proper sense of the word now. I think that once we've worked out its ideas more thoroughly, it might become the basis for a new one. If so, there'll be a great deal of what Nietzsche called the transvaluation of values, a great deal of rethinking all sorts of our terms. But we shall everywhere find what one may call the raw material of divinity, the things which we experience as sacred and transcendent, and we need to refashion, I think, this raw material of divinity and of the transcendent into new symbols which are more in relation to our present world and the changes which are happening. But to sum up, I hope you will agree that this double challenge of this terrifying events and the exciting new revelation of the new explosion of knowledge are immensely exciting and challenging. Don't think we shall get it all, that this shall all be easily applied. Remember that it took the best part of four centuries to get the revolutionary and exceedingly wonderful basic idea that underlay Christianity accepted and put into form, at which it really did begin to be a world force. Now we have better methods of communication, better methods of understanding. Perhaps it'll take only four decades, but it'll take quite a time. But in any case, I would plead for this. I think that there is an urgent need for everybody, especially younger people, or at any rate those who are younger in spirit, to, what I may say, participate in the great debate which these new events and this new knowledge are bringing about. To discuss, for instance, one thing, the implications of this new revelation, with its further implication of fulfillment, in relation to whatever subject they themselves are particularly interested in, whether economics or the arts or ecology or social science or town planning or whatever it may be. I think there should be probably permanent groups discussing the implications of these of this new knowledge in relation to a number of special fields. Sometimes these what you might call the theoretical basis of work in these fields. We have a very good example in Britain of how important such groups may be. The Fabian Society, as you know, was engaged in discussing the theoretical basis of what you really meant by socialism, the idea of socialism, and it still exists, I think, but it's not anymore very influential, but it has made possible the emergence of a strong and intelligent socialist, what we call Labour Party, which has certain fact-founded principles. I think that the same sort of thing could be done in relation to this idea of fulfillment and the new knowledge with a number of other fields. And of course there are the more general implications, the implications for general thought and feeling, implications for religion, about destiny, and so on. But I think the main thing is this, that we are faced with the need for a drastic revolution, and every year we delay coping with it, the problem gets more difficult. In regard to population, for instance, every year it gets 60 million people more difficult. In regard to economic affairs, every year it gets more difficult as you get more vested interests and so on. And as I say, I would appeal to everybody to really to use their best efforts of intellect, reason, and imagination to try and think out jointly with other people the implications of this great revolution in our human affairs.
Sir Julian, I'm sure you can sense from the warmth of the response our appreciation for this brilliant and fascinating discourse this evening. My colleagues, our time is limited. May I suggest that we receive only two questions? Miss Howe, may I have them, please? Do you see any way that this focus on ecology can help solve our problems without a degree of social control that leaves a little place for individual decision?
Yes, I think so. We have, in Britain, we have various reasonably democratic institutions dealing with this problem. In regard to nature, we have the Nature Conservancy, which is doing research on ecology, and you have, and is also buying up areas for national nature reserves, and is taking a great hand in amassing facts about the effect of pesticides and effluents and so forth. Now, that is not human ecology, though it impinges on it. When it comes to human ecology, we've been having some pretty drastic reappraisals in Britain. We've just had the Buchanan report, which I mentioned before, which has been accepted in principle, at any rate with lip service by the government, and which definitely will mean that immense sums will have to be spent in reorganizing the traffic flow, the centers, the all sorts of things in and the administration of our cities. There will be, of course, a considerable amount of what some people think is interference with freedom. Well, you already have it in all American cities. You started these parking meters business. We have it now. It's a rash of parking meters over all our cities. Well, that's an interference with personal freedom, but it's got to be accepted. Like interference with personal freedom, if you catch an infectious disease, you have to be isolated. And we shall certainly have to have more regulation. I hope it won't be too dictatorial. Well, then, as regards the urban sprawl, there are a great many things which you can do to prevent it being disastrous. You can have an overall system of town and country planning, as we are supposed to have. We ought to be much better and more efficient than it is, into which any development, building development has to fit. There must be somebody which decides whether you should have a power station or an aerodrome or a national park in such and such a division. That is only common sense. That is allotting your resources in the best possible way instead of the worst possible way. And then, of course, there will be again, I hope very much, a great deal of interference with the so-called right of the land speculator to make an exorbitant profit by buying up land on speculation for development. We already have in England some powers about this, and the government is making more and more grants to local authorities to buy up land for housing at prices which do not include the development increase, but not nearly enough is being done about that. This seems to me it's socialized, to use a word which I understand is not very popular here, but to me it's none the worse for that. You're going to have to socialize a great many things. The question is whether you socialize them reasonably democratically or only with the aid of authoritarianism, which in the long run just doesn't work. I think that's as much as I could say on that.
Thank you, sir. Is there any future, Sir Julian, for a religion of revelation, such as Judaism or Christianity, which redefines the supernatural realm in terms consonant with human self-understanding, that is, in terms of your proposed humanistic revolution? What must be the direction of the religions of revelation in the future?
Well, I'm afraid that is something which I can't answer. I cannot believe in a separate supernatural realm, so this question doesn't mean anything to me. They've either got to redefine the whole scope of their religion so that everything is natural, or else then I think they will fail to meet the challenge of scientific knowledge. But, of course, there's a great deal of heart-searching going on in England, among Anglicans, Episcopalians. But the result is rather jejune. I mean, it's rather like trying to eat your cake and have it and keep it. I mean, there are a number of people, like the Bishop of Woolwich, and there's some German theologians too, who are really redefining God in a sense which ceases to mean God in the accepted sense of a supernatural being with power to influence natural affairs. And yet they don't want to abandon the word, which is what has such potent semantic and psychological influence for the everyday man. And I don't know what will happen, but it's quite clear that there is a big crisis, and how the supernaturalist religions will solve it is a matter for them, I'm glad to say, and not for me.
Sir Julian, may I thank you again on behalf of the university for coming and spending this evening with us. This has been a thoroughly fascinating discussion. I'd like to thank, too, the members of the Convocation Committee within the College of Liberal Arts for having suggested that we bring here to the university Sir Martin Luther King and Sir Julian Huxley. This has been an excellent discussion. Unhappily, it's just begun, and our time has run out. My colleagues, our students, we are adjourned. Again, Sir Julian, our thanks.